Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. This is Lucy Ash with more extraordinary personal stories from around the world. Today, the doctor who got death threats after trying to save the life of a young woman who became the symbol of the anti-government protests in Iran. Also, the Kenyan dancer teaching ballet in the violent slums of Nairobi. And the British adventure junkie who took his 16-year-old daughter on a trip to the South Pole. But first, in the late 1990s, Arash Hijazi gave up being a doctor in Iran to concentrate on writing and a career in publishing. In the summer of 2009, after finishing a course in the UK, Arash went home to see his family. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad had just been declared the winner in the presidential elections, but millions took to the streets to challenge the result. Arash got caught up in the Green Movement protests which swept across the country. By chance, he was next to a young woman when she was shot in the chest. He tried desperately to save the life of Neda Aga Sultan, but despite his efforts, he failed. The shocking video footage of this young woman dying on the streets in Tehran went global, and she became a symbol of opposition to the Iranian regime. 2.5 years later, because of that tragic chance moment, Arash's life has changed forever. When he came into the Outlook studio, I asked him what happened on June the 20th, 2009.
I knew it was going to be very, very violent on that day. Therefore, I decided not to go out. But a couple of my younger colleagues were eager to go out. And therefore, I said, if you're going out, I'll come with you. Because I felt, you know, as a more senior person, I could protect them in a stupid way. But we didn't have to go long and go far. It was just at the end of our alley where the protests were happening. And that's where I saw Neda for the first time. She was standing among the protesters with her music teacher. I didn't know who she was or who that gentleman was at that time. But she was shouting, "Death to dictator," these kinds of slogans on that day. We watched the anti-protest police on their motorbikes, their batons, their tear gas. There was tear gas everywhere. All of a sudden, they just started on their motorbikes and rushed towards the crowd. That's when we started moving into the same alley that led to our office. And Neda and her music teacher and maybe 10 or 15 other people moved in the same alley. And then we hear the blast. And Neda was standing maybe 3 meters away from me. And my friend told me, "Arash, there's blood coming out of her mouth." And I turned back and I said, "It's not her mouth, it's her chest." And I rushed towards her. And we laid her on the ground and I tried to save her in any way I could, stop the bleeding. And unfortunately, she died in a minute, maybe. Once I realized that she was gone, I stood up. And then fear overwhelmed me at the same time because, you know, there was blood, they were killing people. To be honest, I was afraid of for my own life as well because I looked around, the bullet that had hit her could hit me next. And then I felt embarrassed a little bit because I realized, you know, I looked at her, she was dead on the ground and I was fearing for my own life. And then I was furious and rage overwhelmed me and I just stepped back, leaned to the wall, tried to breathe. And then I saw my friend who was standing next to me. He was trembling. He's the same person who took the footage.
He must have had extraordinary presence of mind to be filming that.
Yeah. But afterwards, he fainted.
Afterwards,
he fainted. So that was the next reaction, to try to take him. We took him to our office. I gave him some water. And he was shouting, "They killed that girl. They killed that girl." So I was trying to calm him down, and it was then when I took the mobile phone from him. I told him, "You've recorded this, and before the internet dies down," because they were, you know, this, it was becoming slower and slower, and until they shut it down completely, we had a very narrow window to get the film out. I said, "Let's send this out to someone to save it." So at that point, I took the camera phone with another friend and we uploaded it to a couple of friends we knew here and there outside Iran. Just our idea wasn't to broadcast it or anything at that point. We just wanted to save inside Iran. It would be very dangerous to keep it. So we just wanted to send it out to be somewhere safe. But that night when I went back home, I saw it was already on the media worldwide.
And what were your feelings when you saw yourself on television like that?
I had mixed feelings. I was happy that, you know, the whole thing had made a difference. I was terrified because my face, I realized that my face was quite clear on the camera. And I was concerned that what would happen next.
So what did you do next?
I booked a flight for the next day out of Iran. So I brought my flight forward and I left the next morning.
Back to the UK?
Back to the UK, yeah. And that was when I was bombarded by the media. They would approach me from, I don't know where they got my contact information, but that's what the media do. So, and I said, I'm not talking today. I have to think. So I spent the evening with my family and I thought about what should I do. I checked the news and I realized that the government of Iran had done anything they could do to discredit the whole story. So first they had claimed that the video was fake, or some accused the CIA, and basically doing everything other than investigating the case properly.
What was it like for you emotionally coming back to Britain then? You talked to your wife about what you'd been through.
Yeah, I talked to her and she had seen me on camera and we hadn't had a chance to, other than a few short emails or something, to talk or anything. And she was terrified. Seeing me was a great relief. But that night I talked to her for a long time to make that decision whether I needed to speak up or not. And she said, "You've done your part. You sent out the video. The world knows about it. Probably it's time to just wait and see what happens." And at that point, that I told her, you know, our parents kept silent when their friends were shot. And this is what happened to Nida and all of the young people, their children. And if I keep quiet today, someday the same thing might happen to our son. And that's when I decided to speak up, and BBC and The Times, I think they were the two media outlets I talked to at that point. And afterwards, I tried to stay out of the spotlight afterwards because I thought that I had said what I needed to say, and then I was targeted, obviously.
So what happened to you then?
So basically, as soon as I spoke up, the day after, they raided our office in Tehran. They claimed in an interview that I was collaborating with the West to plot against the Islamic Republic, making up this story, and later on they claimed that I was even involved in the plot.
Involved in which way?
Oh, in the assassination.
Of Nida?
Yeah. And then they claimed, and then they found out, they said that I was being prosecuted by the Interpol, and they had already asked Interpol to seize me, and In an hour or two, Interpol declared that no, that was this allegation wasn't true, and killed their claims basically. But I've always remained a target for them. They shut down our publishing company in Iran, banned all my books. They interrogated my father for hours, my friends, and I received a lot of anonymous emails that I have to shut up, otherwise they will silence me. And I talked to the police at that point.
The police here took your concerns pretty seriously.
Yeah, they did. And I realized that I couldn't go back to Iran anymore. And I never had a chance to say goodbye to my country, even if I wanted to, you know. It was very painful because I left in such a rush. I didn't have a chance to get any money, any cash or any money out of Iran. I was left here with a wife, a three-year-old son, with no money, nothing, living in fear and in very anxious. So it was a horrible time. I had created that mess for my family, and I really had no clue what to do afterwards. And I started looking for a job, basically. Fortunately, I found a job afterwards. But the fact that I can't go back to Iran is still hurting me a lot.
And there's still the same government there.
It's still the same government. You're inclined to fall into a sense of despair that nothing has really changed. But then again, if you look at it from a different angle, you understand that everything has changed. And that story and similar stories discredited the government of Iran. People are living in very dark times in Iran.
If you had your time again, would you act the same way? Would you take the decision to upload that video?
Yes. I had to do something on that day. And that was the only thing I could do, so I did it. If in a similar situation, this is the only thing I can do, I will do it.
Arash Hejazi, he's written a memoir of life in Iran called The Gaze of the Gazelle. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. Coming up, the girl who sat in a freezer to prepare for a trip to the South Pole. Kenya's giant Matare and Kibera slums are tough places to grow up. They're home to drug addicts, prostitutes, thieves and several gangs. But now, young people are getting a chance to improve their lives and realise their potential by learning ballet. Boys and girls living in the neighbourhood are taking lessons with a former slum dweller turned professional ballet dancer, Mike Wamaya. Outlook's Wairimu Gitahi reports from Nairobi.
It's hard for me to believe what I'm seeing and hearing. I'm in a classroom at Spurgeon Primary School in the middle of Kibera slum. A group of barefooted girls in ballet costumes are dancing gracefully and cheerfully to the music. The stage is a simple structure with a cement floor. As the heavy raindrops hit the corrugated iron roof, the sound is absorbed by music from a stereo that has seen better days.
Done. And finish.
Mike Wamaya is the ballet instructor here.
Number one, syllabus yenye tunafanya ni R&D. Na hii R&D syllabus.
The type of ballet we're teaching them is called Royal Academy of Dance, and it has various dance disciplines. It helps the kids in different ways. When some of them came here, they had very rough characters because of the environment they grew up in, and dancing helps them to calm down. They also learn virtues they can apply in other situations in life, like doing the right thing at the right time. In ballet, you have to move in different ways, depending on the steps required and the music. Dancing also improves their concentration tremendously.
It may improve tremendously.
This school and another based in Madaris Slum was started by a UK-based charity called Anos Africa, which offers arts education to orphans and vulnerable children.
Mike, sometimes the children are starting to dance too early, so we have to make them wait for an introduction, so maybe it's best to ask them to clap for four counts. It's usually counts, yeah, don't you think?
Yeah,
with
four
an
count.
Introduction. So we just make them say, one, two, three, four, and one.
Yes. Ananai from Anos Africa has been training Mike to teach. He was already a dancer, but is now qualified as a teacher. He still attends classes to improve his skills.
Mike is very special. He's very, very mature. He has enormous dedication to the children of the slums. He was brought up in the slums himself, and he believes in ballet. He adores ballet.
I remember when I was doing my final year in primary school, we left our home in Nairobi to go to the rural areas because my father had passed away, and my mother could no longer afford life in the city. A relative had offered to educate me, but changed his mind, so I had to drop out of school. Those were tough days. Often I would go home to find there was no food because we had no money.
The classes that Mike offers these children every week also provides them with some relief from their everyday realities.
For instance, watoto huko na challenges mob ghetto.
Children in the ghetto have a lot of challenges. If it's not the lack of food, then it's something else. But when they come here, even if it's just for a short time, they're all equal. They all wear the same costumes. They've all come here to dance ballet, and they all get the same snacks at the end of the class. When they're here, it doesn't matter if they came hungry or if they came wearing torn clothes. No one even remembers that, because for those few hours, they're all equal.
When I talk to these kids, they're very matter-of-fact about what they get from these classes. 10-year-old Immaculate Anyango tells me that ballet has made her life better because she's stronger these days. And because of this, she can pursue any career she chooses, like a doctor or a pilot.
My name is Faith Alma. My big sister, Gift Gladys, learns ballet here. Since she started taking these classes, she's been more active at home and organises her time better. She used to be lazy, but now she's greatly improved because of the discipline these classes provide. She's also more interested in schoolwork, and she says that she's discovered that she has a gift for dancing ballet.
But there are still parents who are not sure of the value of learning ballet.
At the moment, there's a challenge with one of the parents of the kids I'm teaching at the Matare slum. They have a child who's one of the best dancers we have, but her father has told her not to come anymore because he doesn't see the value of the classes. Convincing parents that ballet is useful to their children is a huge challenge for us. Also, boys wearing tights isn't common in African culture. I believe we can come up with costumes that fit our culture. At the moment, the boys who are in the project do wear tights, but they're also given long T-shirts to wear with them, if they want.
It was an uphill task for Mike to become a professional dancer, but he believes that hard work, perseverance and hope always pay off.
Sunday moja kuna audition.
My own career began when I took part in an audition in my town, and I was among those selected to train as a professional dancer. The organiser told me I had to move to Nairobi for the training. I didn't even have money to get there, so I had to hustle for the fare, and still I didn't know how I was going to get home. I went with one pair of trousers, a shirt, and my training clothes. Now that I'm in a better position, I'm the breadwinner in our family. I provide everything. They look up to me as if I'm their father. I pay school fees for my siblings and for my cousins. I've even built a home for my mother.
Mike dreams of starting his own ballet school, one where he can give slum children the space and the time to fulfill their potential in ballet, as he was able to do.
Wairimu Gitahi reporting from Kenya. Now, Amelia Hempelman Adams, the 16-year-old daughter of the British adventurer David Hempelman Adams, has just become the youngest person to ski to the South Pole. Amelia, who is accompanied by her father on the expedition, reached her destination after skiing 97 miles. She had to spend 17 nights on the ice, enduring sub-zero temperatures, whiteouts, and 24-hour daylight to complete the challenge. Amelia joined me with her father at Bush House in our studio here in London, 2 days after arriving back from the South Pole. I began by asking David why he'd wanted to take his youngest daughter on such an arduous and potentially dangerous journey.
All three of my girls, I've always tried to instill in them that there's no glass ceiling, that they can actually achieve anything they want if they put their mind to it. And what I found with all three, we push our youngsters, and I push mine, of course, in academia, but I think it's a great also way of learning new things, and it's a great education to travel. And I do believe, you know, she went away as a young girl but came back as a young woman, and I think that you know, I could see the difference between before she went, and of course there was the hesitancy of, you know, what's it going to be like out there and coping with those environments, because the bottom line is, you know, it's dangerous, it's cold, it's hostile environment, and it's extreme. And I just think if you give any youngster the training and the background knowledge and the infrastructure, they can achieve anything. And she did.
And when your dad suggested this trip, did your heart sink a little bit, honestly?
No, I kind of wanted to do it myself anyway, because I've heard so much about it. So it was quite nice to actually go on a trip.
Were you worried about the possibility that you might let him down?
Maybe, but I knew he would try his best to try and get me there because of his experience.
And how did you train for it? I mean, obviously you had the example of your older sisters and they gave you some tips, but how did you get yourself into a physical state for it?
Well, before we went into a freezer in a supermarket for a morning.
What, you sat in a freezer?
Yeah.
Are you joking?
No.
Really?
It was about minus 27 in there. We had all our kit on, so wasn't too bad.
And then there was the cross-country skiing.
Yeah.
That that you did, and you'd never done that before?
I had a tiny bit, but not for the distance that I had to do there. But once you're there, your fitness builds up as you go along, so it wasn't actually too bad.
Was there a point where you felt, I just can't go on, I've had enough?
A few times, but the group was really encouraging and supportive, so you just keep going.
What was it like eating, sleeping day to day?
The food wasn't very nice at all. I couldn't really eat the breakfast, it was so gross, so I had lots of biscuits. Dinner wasn't too bad. It's all dehydrated food.
Oh, so it's like in packets and you
add
water?
Yeah, add water to it. I didn't get much sleep at all because it's 24 hours of daylight, so the sun's just constantly beaming into the tent. And then our whole tent, there was everyone snoring, so I hardly slept at all.
So you were doing all this on very little sleep. You must have been exhausted.
Yeah, I was really tired, but I just kind of kept going.
And what was it that kept you going?
Just to try and actually make it to the pole. Most days we had blue skies because we were really lucky with the weather. And then it was just white all around. And you can just see for miles and it's really clear.
How did it kind of affect your relationship, father-daughter relationship? Do you feel closer to your dad now that you've seen sort of his world a bit and and how he does expeditions?
Yeah, I guess so, spending so long with him. Because I haven't spent that much time alone with him before.
It is quite strange, the dynamics. I made sure she was in my tent just to make sure I could keep an eye on her. So obviously the language, there was less swearing and less teasing of the other fellas because you just had to watch, you know, she's a teenager. Out there, very occasionally gets into sort of a man's world of debauchery. So you had to very carefully watch that.
Sort of locker room talk.
Yeah, so we had to stop all that. You get this accumulated fatigue. I was very careful that because we were flying into 9,000 feet and because of the high pressure zone, it feels much higher than it actually is. So I was very careful with the altitude. So the first day we just stopped and didn't do anything. The second day we just did 3 hours and picked it up an hour each day. So by the time we were getting up into the 8 and the 10 hour days, people were getting very, very fatigued. And each morning, you know, it was a struggle for people to get out of their sleeping bags. And I always knew Amelia was okay because you would hear this whistling. And I thought, well, she wouldn't be whistling, and you know, unless she was content with life and she was okay with everything. And that was a very nice, that was the first time I've ever heard that in the mornings in a tent, somebody whistling, and you'd always get this smile. And I just thought, well, she's all right.
What was it like when you actually got there?
Really exciting. We were quite relieved that we actually made it because we were all so tired. We couldn't actually believe that we actually finally got there after so long. So we were really happy.
What did you do to celebrate?
We were all kind of hugging and just congratulating each other. And then we flew back to Union Glacier.
How does it feel to be the first 16-year-old to do this?
Quite proud to be able to do it. But I didn't do it to actually get the record. Just to have the experience of going, really, with my dad.
David and Amelia Hempelman Adams. You can see the pictures of their journey on our Facebook page. That's all for today's programme. I'm Lucy Ash, and I'll be back tomorrow with more extraordinary personal stories from around the world. Do join me then, if you can.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.